Bolster number 3, awareness, what to do with worry. One of the styles of meditation we're going to explore is called mindfulness meditation. Sometimes when I introduce it in my classes, or for that matter, any type of meditation, I get a handful of uncomfortable stares, and some students tell me they're a little intimidated by it. I was too when I first started practicing. I think most of us are. And it seems impossible to practice, especially when you're feeling stressed. And attempting it when you're going through treatment, being asked to sit still and find some peace, I'm doing air quotes again, or quiet your mind, air quotes again, seems not only difficult, but almost impossible. So for those of you who are new to mindfulness meditation or any type of meditation, there are some misconceptions out there about what it really is. So before we get into further practice, let's get our heads and our hearts around some of what we'll be doing. Jon Kabat-Zinn, the founder of mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, defines it as this: the awareness that unfolds as we pay attention on purpose in the present moment. So, meditation is a practice of concentrating on what's happening right now. That's all. There are no requirements to still your mind or quiet your mind at all. We've actually already practiced it with our breathing exercises and mantra. We practiced paying attention to our bodies and minds and our breath right now. Mindful meditation can be done sitting, walking, washing the dishes, eating dinner, combing your hair, brushing your teeth, feeling the wind on your skin, or walking your dog, you name it. It's about bringing our awareness gently back again and again to doing, feeling, and being right now. There's plenty of clinical research on the benefits of MBSR and how it can support cancer treatment. Besides helping to address stressors, it can also help to calm and relieve physical discomfort, difficulty sleeping, fatigue, that generalized feeling sick feeling, and also high blood pressure. I've posted a handful of medical studies on the benefits of MBSR on our website, bolsterandbridge.com, if you're interested in further research information. And please feel free to read these studies if you like, as well as researching on your own. For our purposes here, for right now, we'll be keeping our focus on practicing and learning how it makes us feel better. The concept we're investigating here is how using mindfulness, our awareness, can help us with the worrying mind. Here goes. The truth is, we all worry. It's part of being human. It's normal and natural to worry sometimes. But what we've been talking about here are the times our minds are really unhelpfully and unhealthily occupied. Negative thinking patterns that try to solve, control, or fix a problem, and sometimes search for blame or shame. Like Frank's, hey, leave him alone. Or Bob's idea to no longer meet with the committee, and Ruth's amusement with her once anxiety-causing perfectionism. How do we come to recognize and accept that our worry patterns aren't serving us? Here's a way to look at worry, and here's what we can do. Our thoughts are in a constant state of fluctuation between the future and the past, the what-ifs of the future. What if I do this? What if I don't do that? What if this happens? What if I forget about that? And the list goes on. The what-ifs of the mind create excess worry and anxiety. Focusing on the what-ifs of the future, we put ourselves in an impossible situation. We cannot live in the future. We cannot beam ourselves into the future. We are not on Star Trek. I have a student who refers to this as future tripping, which I love. Now, there are parts of our life that we can plan for and work toward into the future. That's helpful. That's planning. For example, thinking about and writing out your shopping list, or remembering to set out your medications for the day, planning your kids' weddings, preparing for a trip. In these cases, we're doing something now to help take care of our future. This is putting thought into action. In fact, writing out to-do lists are helpful as they put our thoughts on paper so they don't have to keep circling through our minds. Journaling is also a great way to get worry out of our bodies and onto paper where we can process and reflect. Thich Nhat Hanh, world-renowned spiritual teacher and Vietnamese Buddhist monk, says, "The best way to take care of the future is to take care of the present now." I'm going to say it again. It's so good. The best way to take care of the future is to take care of the present now. What an empowering statement. We cannot reach a finish line before we've run a race. We cannot graduate from school before we've taken all of our class requirements. All we can do is what we're doing right now. We can strengthen our muscles of awareness right now. And all it takes is a little practice. Worrying about the future doesn't serve us or change anything. The same goes for the past. Our minds love to go back and try to fix things, relive, reevaluate, attempt to correct past behaviors and decisions. Shoulda, woulda, coulda. I shoulda done this. I should never have said that. I coulda done this differently or that differently. The list goes on. Letting our present be consumed by living with the regrets of the past, it's such a common human predicament. They've made movies about it. One of the most famous movie lines of all time, "I could have been a contender," Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront. Now, there are some things that have happened in our past that we do have some say in. If there's something we can do to help a past situation in the present, we can act. For example, if we need to apologize to someone for something we've said or done. If taking action helps us to feel better, then by all means, we can do that. However, we cannot control how the person on the receiving end will accept our apology. We cannot control another person's behavior, but we can take a step forward for ourselves, for our own peace of mind. Here's a wonderful story that illustrates the fluctuations of thoughts and the difference between our thoughts and higher consciousness. It's called the two-bird meditation, and it goes like this. The story comes from an ancient yogic text called the Upanishads. Two birds are seated on a branch. The first bird flies off the branch, swooping and swirling, diving and soaring, darting up, darting down, flapping its wings wildly, all whilst eating the sweet and sour fruits of life. The second bird stays gently perched on the branch and without judgment or agenda, simply observes that very busy first bird. It doesn't try to quiet or control the first bird's actions in any way. It calmly watches the first bird with its feet on the branch and the breeze blowing through its feathers and its wings softly tucked by its sides. In this story, the first bird represents our thoughts, the constant fluctuations between the what-ifs of the future and the should-haves of the past. The second bird represents our higher self, our awareness. The second bird knows that our thoughts are just that, only thoughts. From these ancient texts, we know that thousands of years ago, people struggled with this very issue. We are not alone in this, and this is nothing new. It's something human beings have been looking to find peace with for a very long time. So rather than quieting the mind or stilling the mind, it's really about changing our relationship with the mind. With the practice of meditation, we begin to recognize that we have two minds, our thoughts and our higher consciousness, also known as the observer. How many of us have driven home from a friend's house or work all the way home and not remembered what streets we took, where we stopped at signs or lights, or how we even got there? This is the power of the worry mind. We're so preoccupied with thinking about something that isn't even happening that we don't recall seeing the road right in front of us. So who's driving the car? As we practice coming back to now, feeling our hands on the steering wheel and putting our eyes on the road, feeling our breath in our body, anything that brings us back, we help to stop stress cycles in their tracks. We're essentially pumping the brakes of our autonomic nervous system, moving us into a calmer state, allowing the systems of the body, like we previously discussed, digestion, respiration, and the immune system, to work more efficiently. we can learn to look at our worry with a sense of compassion, a sense of openness, and a sense of curiosity rather than letting it consume us. It seems counterintuitive to open up to feel the sensation of worry, but by feeling our feelings and staying present, the worry mind begins to lose its hold over us, its power. Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, neuroanatomist, researcher, and national spokesperson for the Harvard Brain Tissue Research Center, has a story that's incredible and inspirational. Dr. Taylor had a stroke in her 40s and, because of her profession, studying the brain, had the awareness to realize what was happening to her. She actually observed herself having the stroke, which helped her not to panic. Thankfully, she was taken to the hospital and made a full recovery. She continues to study the brain, and her life and her work have been featured in many publications and TV shows like 60 Minutes. From her research, Dr. Bolte Taylor has discovered this. Emotion only lasts in our bodies for 90 seconds. After that, the physical reaction dissipates, unless our cognitive brain kicks in and starts connecting our anger with past events. This is a profound discovery from a world-class scientist, so here it is again. Emotion only lasts in our bodies for 90 seconds. After that, the physical reaction dissipates unless our cognitive brain kicks in and starts connecting our anger with past events. So, giving ourselves the opportunity to feel our feelings, breathe, and observe what's happening right now, without feeding what's happening with worry, our feelings will move through us in about a minute and a half. Now, of course, this is easier said than done, and it doesn't mean that we will forever rid ourselves of specific worries in 90 seconds. But it does give us important evidence-based information that the uncomfortable emotions that come along with worry are temporary. Viktor Frankl was an Austrian neurologist and psychiatrist, as well as a Holocaust survivor, and he said, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and freedom." The space he's talking about here is our awareness. In a moment of awareness, we have two choices. We can continue on the worry train, or we can observe our thoughts and evolve. We can soften and take a breath or two. I know I'm breathing in. I know I'm breathing out. We can feel our feelings without feeding the story and begin to put some space, some distance between ourselves and worry. We can watch these thoughts for a few breaths and keep coming back to the sensations of the body right now. I can feel my feet on the floor, the breeze on my skin, my seat in the chair, my breath. I know I'm breathing in. I know I'm breathing out. Our perceptions also play a role in the busyness of the worry mind. Our egos, our attachment to certain ideas, not having all of the right information about a particular subject, our likes, dislikes, our fears. Sometimes our perceptions of what is going on now are not always accurate. They can become so strong that they cloud the reality of the moment. So these misperceptions can often blur what's actually happening. Here's a for instance. You're angry and yelling at your spouse or partner because they've left their dirty clothes on the floor. Maybe you're not just yelling, but completely blowing up at the situation, screaming or crying or feeling a huge amount of anger or frustration that isn't really warranted by some dirty clothes on the floor. But what's really feeding this explosion is something that happened a few weeks ago. Maybe they forgot your anniversary or your birthday. Maybe it was about an argument that you had that wasn't resolved. So it's not really about the dirty clothes on the floor at all. We've all been there to some degree. We often react in the present to the underlying stories of the past. Perhaps our expectations haven't been met. Sometimes we're living in the subtext of our lives. When we practice the awareness of right now, we begin to develop a more clear and accurate view of our lives. It helps us to see through our misperceptions, and we tend to make better choices. And again, we tend to respond rather than react to life. All of this begins to feed a greater sense of calm. We can take a breath, a pause. Buddhists call it being awake. Musicians say when they're playing and their mind and their bodies are so connected to their music, they feel they're in the pocket. They're in the rhythm and the sound of what they're doing right now. Runners say that when they are truly feeling connected to their pace, the feel of their gait and their feet on the ground and their connection to their body and their breath, they feel as though they're in the zone. Their attention and focus are integrated into what's happening now. The Dalai Lama says, "There are only 2 days a year that nothing can be done. One is called yesterday and the other is called tomorrow. So today is the right day to love, believe, and mostly live." Being here now. It's a practice like anything else, like practicing your scales on the piano or practicing your times tables when you were a kid. Whatever we keep doing, we get better at. Whatever we practice, we get better at. Whether it's allowing our feelings and being kinder to ourselves, or constantly worrying and beating ourselves up. And that's what's really comforting about this. We have good days and not so good days, and joyful moments and melancholy moments, and we don't have to try to get anywhere. We can allow ourselves to feel through what's happening, knowing it will pass. There are certain things in our life that we can't think our way out of. There isn't always an immediate answer. There are times of uncertainty. And oftentimes, the most healing approach is to feel our way through. Rainer Maria Rilke, acclaimed Austrian poet, said, "Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer." Let's talk a little more about now. We keep coming back to now, but we know now might not always be the most pleasant place to be. And that's why we often resist it. It's the mind's constant struggle to control now that actually exacerbates our mental and emotional suffering. We often become mental gymnasts trying to leap over the situation or dive beneath it or try to go around it this way or that way. Robert Frost, 4-time Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, said, "The only way out is through. The only way out is through." Later in our bridge exercises, we're going to learn a specific meditation to support us through those especially challenging times of now. One in particular is called the Tonglen Meditation, and this meditation of giving and receiving supports us through our more difficult moments, and always with a deep sense of compassion. Sometimes now is just fine, kind of a neutral place to be. We can feel and experience that too. Now can also be peaceful or joyful or beautiful. The practice of awareness helps us to be present and to make space in our minds, bodies, and souls for all of life to take place. Sometimes it can be challenging to know what is in or out of our control. With the practices we'll be doing here, it will start to get a little easier to decipher. But if you're really having a tough time of it, the Serenity Prayer comes to mind. "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." Some of you may be familiar with this from 12-step programs. I think it's helpful when we're in any phase of healing. And if you feel uncomfortable using the word God, you can replace it with whatever works for you. You can substitute the word God for love or nature or family or friendship or anything you believe is greater than yourself. My husband tells me he thinks about the force in nature that created both the hummingbird and the whale. He says however that happened is beyond his comprehension, so the incredible creative force of nature is what works for him. So substitute whatever works for you. As we move through these practices, remember, it's not about getting it perfect. It's not about getting it right all the time. And it's not about trying really, really hard. That's for my type A friends like Ruth out there. It's about exercising the muscles of awareness. Awareness is not rigid. It's not stagnant. It's living and breathing just like we are. Awareness is the first step to healing.